This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The weather has gone sideways. Emissions are up. Climate talks are useless. Revolution? Not likely. So, in this week's Radio EcoShock show, deep thinker Frank Rotering introduces his desperate new strategy to split the rich and plunge the world economy into steep contraction. Then Gail Zawicki savages what's left while she campaigns against the unknown threat of ozone smog. It's a panorama of inner conversations for twisted times. Politicians and bankers, businessmen, they religiously tell you the economy needs to keep on growing with more products and profits for all. Any sane person can see there are limits to growth on a single planet. As wildlife goes extinct, food chains break up, the climate spins out, we have already surpassed those limits. Even a steady-state economy, steady as we are now, would crush the biosphere we depend on. The only and obvious answer has to be contraction until we reach a sustainable plateau, and that's the territory of Frank Rotering. He's the independent thinker from British Columbia, Canada, and lord of the website contractionism.org. Frank has two books out, including Needs and Limits, A New Economics for Sustainable Well-Being. Prepare to have your basic ideas challenged, listeners. Frank Rotering, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Glad to be here.
Well, before we trash Naomi Klein, the progressive movement, and most of our friends, why don't we establish the basic tenets of your thinking? How would you describe our current rack of problems?
Well, I think you've described them accurately. I think you catch the central tenet of what I'm saying, and that is that the only way we can, concerned humankind, can resolve this crisis we're facing is by rapidly contracting the world's rich economies. Perhaps not all economies, but certainly the rich countries, Canada, the U.S., much of Europe, they have to contract quite dramatically. Again, and as you say, a steady state economy, which was a big topic a few years ago, is simply not sufficient. Rapid contraction is the only way out of this dilemma we're facing currently.
So many people assume we can tinker with the market system. We'll get fossil-free energy and efficiency and recycle things and go on as we are. Why won't that work?
Well, first of all, it's not a market system. I think that's a mystification, Alex. The word is capitalism. Markets can be quite useful beyond capitalism, as I'll discuss as we proceed. So let's not mystify things, okay? The issue here is capitalist logic, the capitalist class, and its growth compulsion, okay? So not markets.
Why can't we just tinker with things the way they are now, with clean energy and recycling? And
well, it's simply insufficient. I mean, those are efficiency solutions, and efficiency is definitely required. What is primarily required is a reduction in consumption and in long-run population. Efficiencies help us slow down the degradation of the environment, but that degradation will proceed, again, unless we rapidly contract our economies. So it's not either or, it's both that are required. And the other thing to say here is that increasing efficiency and tinkering, as you say, with this system is well within the logic of capitalism and is quite acceptable to the ruling class here. But reducing population, and particularly consumption, those things are taboo because that goes counter to the system's core logic, which is to expand. So if we counter that core logic, then we're heading into revolutionary territory, you know, transformative political change, which is what my strategy is all about.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't one of the essences of capitalism the idea that interest will increase the amount of capital? And so that right in that economic model is always the idea of expansion.
Yeah, I don't think interest is the core. I think that's a monetary explanation. I think Marx had a better explanation. I won't get into that in the time we have. In fact, you can understand it historically. I mean, why did capitalism arise in the 16th century? Well, I think the most compelling reason is that the prior economic system in Europe, feudalism, was steady state at a very low level of productivity and production. And there was a need, I think, to expand that. Certainly some sectors of society felt that very strongly, that we needed more production. And capitalism really arose out of that need or perceived need. So capitalism has built within it this dynamic to grow. And as its logic has evolved over the centuries, that has become an intrinsic, inherent part of the system. And there's no way to tinker our way out of that. We have to historically supersede this growth-dependent system.
You talk about a capitalist class. If I have a pension invested in stocks or savings in a bank, am I not willy-nilly a member of this capitalist class?
No, you're certainly not. You're sucking at the trough. You're at the teat, but you are not a controller, an owner. You are not in power. No, by no means are you a member of the capitalist class if you simply siphon off a few dollars through a pension or other means. Absolutely not.
Now, you mentioned Karl Marx, and I can't avoid a comparison to some of your writing and that of Karl Marx, who was really the founder of communism, we might say, or at least of socialism. Where are you the same and where different? And I realize that's, you could probably write a book about that alone, but can you give us a couple of pointers?
Yeah, well, I'm an admirer of Karl Marx intellectually. I do subscribe to his analysis of capitalism, and I use some of his analysis, in fact, to explain why a capitalist economy must grow. For the rest, however, I certainly am not a Marxist. I disagree strongly with Marx's productivism. In other words, progress is equal to increased economic production. I disagree with Marx's notion of human nature, which is based solely on social and not biological realities. I don't subscribe to much of Marx's revolutionary or historical theories, but his understanding of capitalism, I think, was unsurpassed.
But have you not called for a need for a revolution?
My strategy, which is now waning, by the way, one of the things I'd like to talk about, my initial strategy in the rich capitalist countries was called contractionary revolution. And that was indeed, as you indicate, a bottom-up Marxist-style revolution. Of course, the socialist model is that the working class overthrows the capitalist class. And I think to some degree unconsciously borrowed that model and felt that progressive elements in society and some conservative elements might be able to ally, especially as ecological degradation became more acute and visible, and overthrow the capitalist class in the standard socialist sense. And that, I felt for a long time, felt that was weak and perhaps untenable because of the time constraints, the complexity of building such a movement, etc. I basically held on to that model until I read Naomi Klein's new book. A good friend of mine here said or felt that Klein was moving towards a revolutionary position. And I thought if that is indeed true, then perhaps there is hope for progressivism in this vein, a revolutionary vein, and perhaps this strategy of mine can work. I've since read her book about a week ago. And it's very, very clear that Naomi Klein is not and will never be a revolutionary. And insofar as she is a influential leader of the progressive movement, it's also clear that progressivism will not be revolutionary. So with that pretty well pinned down, I now am searching for and developing a new strategy. I think a contractionary revolution can still work in some countries on the planet. Perhaps the poor countries with a revolutionary background, with a more mature, politically mature working class and populace. In the rich countries, progressives, I think, have been socially controlled by the capitalists. The populace certainly is under complete social control. I can't conceive of a revolutionary way out of this. So I think for the rich countries, my former strategy is not workable in the time available to us ecologically.
You know, one thing that Greens don't like to talk about too much is that there is a trend where some Green groups are funded by foundations, and those foundations got their money from capitalists who made lots of money, and then perhaps the next generation felt badly about it and wants to pass it around and make some changes. But there's always constraints, you know. Don't be too radical. Find us some solutions the way they are now. Do you see that as a problem?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the core problem with environmentalism and now progressivism, is that these movements were initiated and developed to work within the boundaries of the current system. And they can do fine work within that, achieving social justice and, you know, moving towards a greener economy. These are good things, but they are limited things. And the ecological crisis is an extreme, urgent, existential crisis requiring fundamental transformative change. And yeah, if you take your money from the people making the big bucks, then there's no way you can be independent, no way you can make a solid contribution to overcoming our overshoot.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with my guest Frank Rotering from British Columbia. Frank, I'm trying to picture a campaign slogan, "If I am elected, you will all make do with less." What kind of political system can oversee a contraction of the economy?
I don't think an election is going to do it, Alex. I think most of us are under the, what I call the democratic illusion, that the government holds power and that the populace, people as a whole, have sovereignty to do what they want, basically, through government. I think that's a myth, okay? I think we ought to take seriously the proposition, the Marxist proposition, that, you know, the capitalist class dominates this society and rules. So if you elect a contractionary government or a green government, you can do certain things in the policy realm, but you can't fundamentally transform this economy. You will be harassed, you will be overthrown, and you'll be assassinated. This is simply not realistic. Okay, so your premise there of an election, I think, is naive, to be honest with you. So I can't answer the question. I think the premise is invalid.
Good enough. Well, I'm having trouble even picturing what contraction would look like. I've only grown up with growth all my life. What would it be like to live in a time of a big contraction?
It would be painful. It would be painful because there is a strong element of human nature involved here. We all like expansion because, you know, we have some strong natural tendencies, I hate to say it, to want more. You know, an easy life is better than a hard life for most people. And this is quite natural. So we, as a species, especially in the rich countries where, of course, we're spoiled rotten, we will have to make do with a lower standard of living as currently perceived. We're going to have to go back to some, you know, social entertainments, to, you know, a cheaper way of doing things, far less travel, obviously, far less, you know, consumption generally. So it will be a difficult transition. There's no way to downplay that. But again, if it's done in a revolutionary context, if society as a whole is changing, and this is accepted from the top, the media talks about this, artists express this, and it is a common theme for people, then it will not be that difficult. Okay, but it will be going against the grain of human nature to some degree. So it'll be a difficult but exciting period.
What about the poorer people in the developing world? Won't they be cheated out of a healthier society, better food, medical care, and all that? Can we really demand peasants stall out at their current level?
If you hold to the capitalist model of development, the productivist model of development, that more outputs means a better, healthier society, then yes, but I think that model is not valid. Okay, I think every society must undergo its own inherent indigenous mode of development. In some cases, that might mean more outputs, but in many cases, it will not. It's quite clear from all the research we've seen that more outputs don't produce happier people. This is pretty clear by now. I think that is a capitalist myth, that we have to keep growing for the poor people of this world. I don't believe that's true, okay? I think every society has to develop in its own way, and in many cases that will not require more outputs, hence growth.
Well, we've talked about the possible painful nature of degrowth, as others call it, but there are also people who argue if we just leave things the way they are, we're going to slam into a depression anyway for economic reasons, for ecological reasons, for a lot of reasons, perhaps overpopulation as well. So is there a way that we can plan our descent?
Well, we have to plan our descent, but the question is, who is we here? First of all, the degrowth movement, by the way, I'm very suspicious of. I've read their materials and their website stuff, etc. Nobody can even define what the word degrowth means, okay? For some, it means contraction. For some, it means we shouldn't be worried about growth, positive or negative. It's a very fuzzy movement that's sort of on the fringes of the ecological economics movement. So I have deep suspicions about degrowth. It seems to me it's just academic game playing and attending conferences. I see nothing coming out of that strategically that is useful. Will there be a depression anyway? Could be, but that really doesn't matter. We're trying to transform the economy here. So what happens under capitalist guidance really doesn't interest me. We're trying to change things. Can we plan? Well, again, in a post-revolutionary situation, okay, if contractionists, as I call them, are in control, then clearly, yes, this will be a planned move. I think the implication of your question is, and the degrowth people would say implicitly, can we, society as a whole, under capitalism, plan our descent? And the answer is no. Under capitalism, you cannot do so. It's a growth-dependent system, as you indicate, as I assert, as Naomi Klein asserts. So you can't plan for that under capitalism. It has to be in a post-capitalist environment. And I think that your next question should be, okay, Frank, what is your current strategy for that? Because I think that's the key here. Let me make a general comment before going on here, Alex. I think all of us, you know, you with your radio show and people like Naomi Klein and others, should start talking not about, you know, speculations about the future and not about how deep our problems are, but I think we all have to start talking almost constantly about a strategy for getting out of this. Okay, what is the proper strategy? What happens to power? What happens to capitalism? Who is we? What are the social divisions? Who is going to rise up against whom to do what? These are the fundamental questions I'm trying to address with my work. And in thinking strategically, I have come to an impasse here because of the limits of progressivism. And I do have a new strategy that's currently unfolding in my head, and I'll be writing about that in a new book out next year. And it's called A Conservative Revolt. And it's quite different. It is not revolutionary, as I've been speaking. It is not revolutionary. It's a revolt. And I'd like to spend our remaining time, if you're okay with it, discussing this new theory and inviting your listeners to critique it. Okay? I'm looking for constructive criticism. Tell me where I'm wrong in this non-revolutionary strategy. Are you okay with that?
I would love to do that. Let's do it.
Okay. So just to recap what I said earlier, my initial strategy, again, for the rich capitalist countries was what I called contractionary revolution, which was basically progressive and some conservative elements allying and then revolting against the capitalist class. I called those revolutionaries contractionists, and I called the capitalist class expansionists for obvious reasons. Again, I don't believe at this stage that this can work. Again, the main reason there is that Naomi Klein's book has made it very, very clear that she, and by extension, progressivism generally, is not revolutionary and will never be in my lifetime or in the ecological time we have. So a new strategy is required. What is that? What could it possibly be? So if the impetus for fundamental change is not coming from below, from progressives, environmentalists, workers, indigenous people, youth, religious people, okay, the people not in control of this society, if they will not rise up, as I believe they will not, then the solution must lie at the top of this society, okay? And this goes against the grain. I'm a lifelong progressive. But I have to face facts here. And the facts here, I believe, and again, criticize me, please, but I think the facts are that we have to rely on the capitalist class itself for our salvation here. Okay, not the capitalist class as a whole. I believe what is happening slowly and what we have to accelerate is a split within the ruling capitalist class. I believe and hope that there are a lot of rational capitalists out there who are becoming increasingly concerned that their personal and business interests are now being threatened. I think if this is instigated, if I can build a theory around that, then it may be possible over the next 5, 10, 15 years to split that class into those elements willing to consider a contractionary economy and those people, the oil industry, et cetera, who will likely remain expansionary. So I basically see, as really the only hope, the only remaining strategic hope I see, is a split within the capitalist class and then contractionists expelling, purging, so to speak, the expansionists, possibly compensating them. For instance, again, the oil industry, they're going to lose a lot of money in this. Why wouldn't we compensate those people? I mean, revenge at this point is futile. We want to salvage the biosphere, not exact revenge on people we don't like. So possibly we can compensate the expansionists, okay, sideline them, just the way we give CEOs the golden parachute to get out of the way, and then have these rational capitalists continue, you know, as the ruling class, but then conducting business not in an expansionary environment, but in a contractionary environment. And we would challenge them from below. Can you do this? Are you resilient and flexible and intelligent enough to conduct business in a contractionary environment? And I think that's a challenge that at least some of them may take up.
It's interesting that you're going this route. I've just run audio from the billionaire Michael Bloomberg and from former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin and the current Treasury Secretary talking about climate change as a real threat to their business interests and that they should do something about it. So I think there's some room for what you're talking about, but it does seem counterintuitive to think that capitalists, who you have said are expansionists by definition, to then rearrange themselves to become contractionists and hopefully for them still make money out of it. It's a long reach. It's a desperate act.
Number one, let me correct you. I did not say that capitalists were expansionary. I said capitalism as a system was expansionary. Now, you're obviously correct that virtually all capitalists today are indeed expansionary. But that's partly because, again, there is no theory out there. There is no alternative contractionary capitalist type system that anybody has imagined for them to hold on to. You know, like everybody else, they need theory. They need a rational argument that is consistent with their interests. And that leads them into a contractionary path. So I think one of the things that people like you and I and other thinkers on the left in the progressive world among concerned humankind, what we should be doing is in a sense helping them out, producing that theory, encouraging them, instigating them, pressuring them, okay, giving them some way out. Because imagine how difficult it is. Let's say you are a capitalist, you understand, you're an intelligent person, you read the papers, you understand what's coming down the pike, the destruction of the biosphere. Okay, and you're scared, but you are a capitalist. What you gonna do? What's the way out? You know, for them too, this is a real conundrum. It's not just us. It's them. They too have a real problem. Even if you have, you know, the best interests of your business and your family at heart, where are you going to go? So I think that my task for the rest of my life is going to be to create the theoretical underpinnings for what I call the conservative revolt. The revolt among not just capitalists, but conservatives generally. And by the way, there's a real history here which has been suppressed for a long time now, that conservatism originally, back in the days of Edmund Burke, French Revolution, prior to, you know, real capitalist expansion. So the conservatism that comes out of the feudal period is not pro-capitalist, it's anti-capitalist. It aims for humility, prudence, community, environmental stewardship, and a lot of other things that we agree with. And one of the things I'm trying to do in my new strategy is I'm trying to appeal to those traditional conservatives to come out of the woodwork and to pressure their expansionary colleagues to drop this expansionary destructive tack. This was, and certainly is now, a historical mistake, and I think traditional conservatives can help us in that task. It's not just progressives from below. It's also traditional conservatives within the ruling circles.
All right, now I'm going to offer a quick and probably ill-formed criticism right now, and that would be this, that historically it sounds like this idea is in danger of falling into what I would call the hero theory. Now, in the Middle Ages, the common person seeing many injustices often said to themselves, well, if only the king knew, I'm sure that he would change things. But in fact, the king knew and was part of the system. So for us to think that some billionaires are going to save us seems to relieve us also of the responsibility of going to the gas pumps and filling up our SUV, of doing all the things that we are doing personally, each one of us, to contribute to this problem.
I don't see the contradiction at all, Alex, not at all. We can keep doing what we're doing to try to minimize our impact on the planet, and we can provide this pressure, as I mentioned, on conservatives and capitalists to split into ecocidal and non-ecocidal factions. We can do all that. It's not one or the other at all. And this is not the king we're talking about, or a few billionaires, which, by the way, Naomi Klein does a good job of critiquing. She calls her chapter No Messiahs, and I agree with her. Michael Bloomberg is not going to save us. Richard Branson is not going to save us. I'm talking here about a sizable segment of the ruling class, the capitalist class, which understands, based on their interests, not the goodness of their hearts, but their personal and business interests, that ecocide is not favorable to them, that they must do something to salvage their wealth, their business, their influence, and, of course, their lives and the lives of their families. So I'm talking not about a king or a few messiah-like billionaires. Again, that's Naomi Klein's critique, but a sizable segment of the ruling class, which rationally, based again on their interest, splits off from the people who are leading them and everybody else to destruction. That is not such a stretch. The king thing is a stretch. Bloomberg and Branson, that's a stretch.
If Radio EcoShock listeners want to take part in this debate with you, how do they contact you?
There's contact information on my website, which, as you say, is contractionism.org. I would love to receive criticism. Again, I am planning my next book, which will likely be titled Conservative Revolt. I realize that this is a stretch for many readers. It's listeners. It's a stretch for me, Alex. Again, I'm a lifelong progressive, and I want to see a bottom-up revolution, which will allow us to address social justice as well as sustainability. But I'm also a realist. I've got about 10 years left in my life, perhaps, and in that time, I want to do what is strategically rational. I want to find the right path for humankind to get beyond this ecological crisis. And I think we, all of us, have to make ourselves responsible for that solution. You know, we have to stop whining about the problem and how serious it is or how near it is, you know, near-term extinction and all that, and ask ourselves, what is the right strategy? And if Frank is wrong, then what is the right strategy? So don't just criticize me, okay? Write me, again, at the contact information on the website, and tell me what the alternative is. We have to start thinking strategically. How do we get out of this mess?
From British Columbia, Canada, we've been talking with Frank Rotering. He's an independent thinker, as you see, developing an economic theory based on the contraction of the world's economy. You can find out more at his website, contractionism.org. Frank, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Alex.
It's been great. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. The blog is called Wit's End. So far, it's been read over 11 million times. The author, I want to say artist, really, is Gail Zawacki. She's edgy. She's on a campaign to save trees from air pollution. But mostly, Gail's in a battle against the never-ending conceits humans use to pretend about ourselves. Gail, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I can't believe it's 11 million. I think most of those are mishits. Like, they're looking for something else, and they land on my blog and go, oh, no, I don't want to be here.
Actually, it's really well written. The pictures are great. The subject is passionate. I know why people come. I love reading it, even though it hurts sometimes. Why is the Cheshire Cat your icon?
Oh, wow. That's such a good question. I guess I've always loved Lewis Carroll and the whole notion of absurdity. And in fact, lately I've gotten immersed in Camus' writings again about that. And the Cheshire Cat is just such a sort of cynical, sneering, laughing figure that I guess that's why I didn't really think about why I chose it. I just sort of did.
Well, look, you just blasted the big green group Conservation International and their movie stars who are pretending to speak for nature. What's the problem with that?
Right. I really didn't pick on them because they're movie stars. I just happened to come across one of the videos. That's the first one that Julia Richards did. And I see those actors, these very wealthy people, her and Harrison Ford and Robert Redford and the other people that are speaking in the videos, not as giant hypocrites really, but more like giant figures of all of us, where they are advocating that we take care of nature, but in their own lives, they are absolutely destroying nature much faster than anybody can dream of with their private jets and their multiple homes and their, you know, really outsized carbon footprints and so forth. So I did kind of use them more as an example because the extremity of the difference between what they're claiming they're working for and what they're actually doing in their lives is so outsized. I just found it kind of amusing, actually.
Okay, now this September, there was a big climate march in nearby New York City. It's nearby to you, trying to motivate the United Nations and world leaders to finally do something, anything, about climate change. Why didn't you go?
Well, it's not near me. I mean, I did go on to the Monday, Flood Wall Street. I didn't go to the one on Saturday. I would have gone, to be honest, because I have a lot of criticisms of 350 and the whole movement and the whole sort of progressive liberal uselessness of it all. But they're the only game in town. I mean, and I went to Occupy Wall Street for the same reason. I didn't agree with all of their stated goals or their premises, but at least they're doing something besides watching TV and munching, you know, Cheetos. So I would have gone Saturday, but my daughter was to be honest, was in a horse show, and I didn't want to miss seeing her because it was kind of a big deal. So I went to see her Saturday, and I felt a little bit better about it when I learned that there was going to be this other action on Monday that was related. So I went to the Monday.
And how did that go, Flood Wall Street? How'd that go for you?
That was a fiasco. I may never do any more activism after that. It was so disappointing. I met with one friend that I'd planned to meet, and I ran into another friend that I hadn't planned to meet. And so the three of us were quite dismayed because we had specifically gone because we were told it was presented as an arrest, as, you know, civil disobedience. We're going to march onto Wall Street. We're going to sit down in front of the stock market and we're going to be arrested. And I felt like, well, that's a little more interesting to me. It's a little more of a statement than just having a Sunday parade when you're not disrupting traffic and you've got a permit, you wave some signs and go home. So we were there for that purpose, and the whole thing was derailed, and it may be forever a mystery exactly what happened, that the police, the mayor's office made some kind of deal with the organizers, and whether they were just blindsided, taken by surprise, or whether they were complicit from the beginning, I don't know, but they decided not to go for the civil disobedience arrest, and they stopped short of marching onto Wall Street. And there was a lot of discussion. We three were not the only angry people there. There were some very vocally furious people that they had gone to a lot of trouble. And also it's just it's a big emotional ordeal to decide to be arrested because there's always the risk of getting injured. And, you know, of course, losing your liberty is always frightening. And so it's people who had made that choice, and there were several hundred people that had gone through that process, to have it sort of snatched away from them arbitrarily by the organizers who are supposed to be, oh, this is a equal organization, bottom-up decision-making, and they just announced, no, we're stopping here. It was very distressing. So, yeah, it was just sad. It was just a big, giant, epic failure, in my opinion.
Well, you know, it seems to me it's a little more risky in the United States than it is in, say, Canada or Britain or Australia to have a protest. I mean, it always amazes me, Gail, when Americans see U.S. troops kicking in doors in Iraq, they don't seem to realize that these same guys come back and go to work for the police or the prisons with many of the same weapons donated by the Pentagon. That population control and force is so well developed in America, it seems hard to imagine any kind of rebellion, no matter how bad things get. Is revolution even possible in America?
I doubt it. But I have to say that, I mean, people in other countries really do get their heads cracked quite a lot in demonstrations, including in Britain and Canada and, you know, anywhere you might name. And then, of course, in even more lawless countries, they get murdered in the middle of the night. You know, a lot of forest activists and people like that. So I don't think that police actions are the reason that Americans have a revolution. I think there are other systemic reasons that Americans are not willing at this point to into the streets the way, for instance, the people in Hong Kong have been. I'm not really sure what all those reasons are, but a lot of it is just, it's fear. I think when people see themselves sliding down the economic ladder, they're less likely not to protest. And then you also have the whole student loan. I mean, when I first started Occupy Wall Street, I kind of thought they were a bunch of whiny kids about their student loans. And then I realized that it actually is a very effective way of suppressing dissent, because traditionally young people are the ones that are dissenters. But now they're all obligated into this debt that can never be discharged, and they can't afford to risk arrest and to be protesting because they've got to keep their jobs and keep paying their student loans. So it is a pretty pernicious way that the government has figured out to keep the youth of the country subdued.
Well, let's switch gears to your personal battle to show people leaves. Gail, why is your blog filled with photos of blotchy plants and dying trees?
Well, I guess because nobody else is really doing very much about it. I mean, there has certainly been many, many, many scientists and hundreds and thousands of research papers written about what air pollution does to plants and trees. But there is almost nobody who's actually saying it's not just something that we should be writing papers about and studying. It's actually causing the ecosystem to collapse globally. And most, virtually all scientists shy away from that, and the ones that do come out and say things a little stronger get ridiculed by other scientists. A famous example, well, only famous in my little world, is the authors of An Appalachian Tragedy, who did come out and say, they wrote a book, it came out in 1999, it said that ozone pollution is killing trees from Georgia up to Maine. And of course, you can extrapolate that to the entire world, but this was their area of specialty. And I got in a little bit of a tiff with Howie Neufeld, who works with the EPA on the ozone issue, and he's working, you know, been working with them on their new regulation, which is due every 5 years. It's coming up in 2015. And I said to him, I wrote to him, I was quite angry, and I said, why aren't you jumping up and down with your hair on fire? You know about ozone. You know the issue. Why aren't you saying that this is a huge problem for the entire ecosystem? And I said, have you read An Appalachian Tragedy? And he wrote back and he said, the only tragedy is that that book ever got written. Because the scientists who wrote it were just ridiculed by the establishment forestry world, which is in the back pocket of the lumber industry, which is part of the fossil fuel industry. And it's almost, you could almost put on a tinfoil hat here and say that there's a conspiracy of silence. So I guess I write about it because I just feel that it's so important and people need to know about it, and nobody else is really saying that.
In an email, you mentioned to me that Jack Fishman was speaking out about it. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Jack Fishman, I just came across a few months ago, his work. He wrote a book in, I think it was 1990, called Global Alert. Now, you can't get a little much more alarmist than Global Alert, which is the title of the book. And I read it, and I was like, holy cow, the whole thing is about how ozone is killing trees. And he is a very distinguished scientist, was working at, I think it was University of Colorado then, and I'm not sure where he is now, but he's worked with NOAA. He was one of Paul Crutzen's graduate students, and he worked very closely with Paul Crutzen about the ozone hole in the stratosphere. And what happened was, when they were studying the hole in the stratosphere, they started asking themselves, and this is way back, I guess, in the early 80s, what's happening with ozone in the troposphere, because they couldn't separate it when they looked at the layers from satellites. So he worked on that, and that too was ridiculed. Oh, don't be silly. There can't be ozone in the troposphere. You know, people can't be making that much pollution that it's an issue. And it turns out that it is an issue. So he wrote this book, and at the end of it, there was an epilogue dated 2004. And it was all about how his daughter had grown up, and the world was so much better because the pollution problem had been taken care of, and so on and so forth. So I wrote to him, dear Dr. Fishman, I'm sure you know your business a lot better than I do, but do you really think that pollution's gotten better? Because with China and the precursors are traveling around the world now, it's gotten so much worse. And he wrote back to me rather sardonically, and he said, the epilogue was a fantasy. It was a hopeful fantasy. And he said, unfortunately, it's still a fantasy. And I said, oh, okay. And since then, he's actually sent to me a link to a lecture that maybe only had 100 views on YouTube that he gave for Paul Crutzen's 80th birthday celebration at the Max Planck Institute. And he started off with some sort of sentimental, personal things about the relationship, and then he went into what ozone is doing to the biosphere. And the title of his lecture was, "Are We Creating a Toxic Atmosphere?" Again, you can't get a whole lot more alarmist than that, because it was a rhetorical question. The answer is yes, our atmosphere is, it's poisonous. And that's what he talked about. But even Dr. Fishman, much as I revere him for the work he's done, is not jumping up and down with his hair on fire, because scientists just don't do that. So what he's doing is he's working on making these ozone gardens for children in arboretums and science museums where they grow plants that are notoriously susceptible to ozone, that happen to show visible damage more than others, like on their leaves. And so that children can go to the gardens and say, "Oh, look what our air pollution is doing to the plants." And I'm like, well, that's wonderful, but there's no time left to educate the children. That's not what we need to be doing, because they're not going to inherit a habitable climate at this rate, let alone plants that, you know, the monarch butterflies can feed off of. So that's my story on Dr. Fishman. And I did actually transcribe some excerpts from his book in a blog post of mine. If people want to read part of it, they can, or you can Google it online and read excerpts in Google Books. But it's a great book. Yeah, I think it was called "There Goes the Neighborhood." So if you Google my blog and "There Goes the Neighborhood," you'll find my email exchanges with him and parts of his book there, and a link to his lecture, which is really, really worth watching.
I'll do all that, and I'll put the links in my blog too at ecoshock.info. This is Radio EcoShock with the witty blogger and activist from New England, Gail Zawacki. On the other hand, Gail, you seem nervous about what would happen if governments in North America or China suddenly took action and cleaned up air pollution, or maybe there could be a stock market crash, which seems to be happening right now, which would close the factories and ground the commuters, or maybe a disease like Ebola could shut the system down for a few weeks or months. If pollution stops for any reason, what happens?
Well, we'll heat up quite a bit. There's a great BBC documentary that came out several years ago called Global Dimming. It's just riveting to see how they learned that the aerosol pollution is masking warming. And Mark Jacobson, who's a professor at Stanford, was on that late night, I can't remember his name, but he was on one of those, I guess, the Late Show or whatever. And he was talking about, he's actually believes in green technology saving the world, but he said that it's masking half of the warming. So in other words, if the pollution was gone from the skies, it will get twice as warm almost instantly, which is huge, because you can see what the warming we've had so far is already doing in terms of the crazy weather that we have and the extreme floods and the droughts and so on and so forth. So it's very significant. And I don't really think it's going to happen because governments get their act together and clean up pollution. I don't think they're ever going to do that. But I think it will happen when we have a collapse of industrial civilization. And that at some point is inevitable. I don't know when. And I'm not sure what is going to trigger it. Could be, like you said, it could be Ebola. It could be an economic crash. It could be peak oil. Any number of things. But it certainly is not going to continue forever. And when it does come to an end, you are going to have instant, almost instant heating, because those aerosols will filter out within a matter of weeks. They'll be gone.
Well, Gail Zawacki, neither one of us is scientists, but we both try hard to keep up with the science as best we can. And my own worry is that if we get a few very hot years or even hot months, natural systems will shift and they won't go back, even if the temperature drops back down again, or maybe that an unnaturally warmer climate doesn't cool down even if the trigger is removed. What are your thoughts?
I would say we're past the tipping point. I mean, you read a lot of ecology papers and they warn about approaching tipping points. And it's the same thing that a lot of scientists say. They're always saying, oh, it's 5 minutes till midnight. And my question is, when is it ever going to be midnight? You've been saying 5 minutes to midnight for 50 years now. I think we're past the tipping point. Well, for instance, I think you just did a segment on that World Wildlife Fund story that we've lost 50% of wildlife population in the last 40 years. I call that a tipping point. 90% of the large ocean fish are gone. So that's well worse than that World Wildlife Fund report, shocking as that is. So the tipping points have been crossed. We're never going to go back to a healthy biosphere in terms of what humans need to survive.
You know, I suppose New Englanders know about an unsteady climate. You had winters where people played tennis in New York in January, and then a brutally cold winter from the Arctic. You had a series of storms, like Hurricane Irene was just laden with surprising amounts of rain and that pounding from Hurricane Sandy. That must have people there on the edge, or do people just quickly forget about all that and go on about their daily lives?
Well, I think for the most part, they forget and they go. I mean, it's like the UK is a good example. They've had the most unbelievable flooding for the last 2 years. And I have friends that say it's ridiculous how quickly people forget. But I do also think that it's unsettling in a deeper level. I think there's a kind of anxiety that is pervasive. And I think that you can see it in popular culture, like a Radio Lab just did this great segment on nihilism, and whether it's a new phenomenon or whether it's always been there, or, you know, what's causing it to sort of really seep into popular culture right now. It's wonderful. Actually, they did two segments on it. And I think that there's always been a sense, going back to Malthus and well before, that mankind is very foolish. I mean, the Greeks talked about it quite a bit, and I don't know Chinese culture very well at all, but I'll bet you anything they had their Cassandras as well. And the reason is that I think it's just so obvious on a very basic level that you cannot continue to grow forever on a finite planet. And yet that is what all of our activities are predicated on, is the notion that, you know, a couple can have 5 or 10 children and we can, you know, continually expand. We can take over more and more habitats. We can destroy more and more animals, blow up more mountains, and it won't matter because we'll just invent new technology. On the face of it, that's ludicrous. But most people don't question it. And if they do question it, they quickly stop questioning it and move on, because the implications are really frightening. And very few people, and it's an interesting question to me as to why it is that there are so few people and what distinguishes those few people that actually will stare into the abyss, which was the title of one of those Radio Lab stories that I was talking about. There must be some kind of mechanism, or maybe life trauma event or genetic mutation. I don't know what it is that causes some people to be able to do that. And I was actually just thinking about it this morning, because in addition to Lewis Carroll and all of his Alice in Wonderland stuff, I've always loved the Wizard of Oz story, especially if you read the original books, not just the movie, which is also great, but the original books are really fascinating. And that idea of in the Emerald City, where people all had the green glasses, people look through life through a distorted lens, which is in their brain. It makes them have an optimism bias. I mean, there's all kinds of more recent neurological studies and things that have shown that people really aren't in the driver's seat. They're driven by their optimism and their desire to believe that the future is predictable, and also more fundamentally that they're never going to die. But every now and then, somebody doesn't have those green glasses on, or they have them and they lose them. And it's very interesting to me to look at different people that were able to do that, like Bosch. I've been looking at his paintings lately, and he was very into the symbolism of whether or not people have free choice and the anxiety. And there were myths in the 1400s, very prevalent myths about how people feel constant anxiety because they have to make the choice between good and evil. Good and evil being living it sustainably as good, and evil as being foolish, like Ship of Fools. That's where I came at it from, with that whole metaphor of the Ship of Fools.
Yeah, Hieronymus Bosch, he was in the 1300s, 1400s, somewhere in there?
1400s, yeah. Late 1400s, early 1500s. But he was drawing on even earlier mythology. The Ship of Fools came well before him, and it was just it was the way that people lived then, was they understood that there's a fundamental tension between people's appetites and greed and what they need to do to be prudent. And it's funny to me, because right now our kind of current religion in America among environmentalists, a lot of them, is sort of this noble savage theory of indigenous people, that they were more close to the earth and understood nature. But that does two disservices. Indigenous people were no more sustainable than, you know, white European supremacists. They also went into overshoot with population, and they had constant warfare and battles, and, you know, this has been well documented in archaeology. It's a universal with every biological creature, that they go into overshoot and their population crashes, and then as they have more food, they grow, and then this is just a constant in life. in general. But the sort of mythology of the noble savage not doing that and living sustainably, and to me, it's ignorant. And the more I read, the more I realize how ignorant I am about how well studied these issues have been going back centuries and centuries, ever since you can go through any kind of written record. This is something that people have been grappling with unsuccessfully, because we can sometimes intellectually see that there are limits. I mean, look at the Limits to Growth report that came out in 1972. That was pretty comprehensive. But so people can intellectually read about that, but they just reject it because it would require sacrifice on their part, and people don't want to sacrifice.
That's a tough question. Why some people get it and others don't. I like to think most of my listeners do get it, which is kind of nice at least. What is your position on the near-term extinction argument posed by Professor Guy McPherson?
That's something I tend to skirt just a little bit, because I'm not sure it really matters, because I think that we're headed for such a crash that if any people manage to survive, they are going to envy the dead. I think it's going to be extremely ugly, because it's going to be global, because we're so interconnected now, and because there's so many of us. So I take exception with Guy on some of his presentations, and I'm not 100% convinced that the methane class rates are going to fire in a short time frame. They might. I'm not saying they won't, but I'm not saying I'm sure that they will. And if they do on a longer time frame, we may not be around to see it, or most of us may not be around to see it. So I really admire him for bringing up the near-term extinction, because I think it's a possibility, and I also think that it's good for people to be able to talk openly about that prospect, because it raises all of the essential questions about how we live and who we really are that don't get discussed by the sort of techno-fantasist people that think that we're going to get out of this basic predicament we're in with technology. Like, I was just reading that the World Bank came out and said that they're so thrilled because China has come on board to impose a carbon tax. And my reaction was, well, great, when we have a baby tax, then I'll think we're getting somewhere. Because the whole carbon issue is just one symptom of overshoot. The other symptoms, like, for instance, that World Wildlife Report that came up earlier, when they talk about species disappearing, they only attribute 7% of the loss to climate change. The rest is habitat destruction, just out and right killing and poisoning them, all the pollution. These are the big killers. I'm not saying that climate change won't ultimately be the big mama of killers. It will be. But right now, even if you didn't have climate change, we're destroying the earth. We're destroying a habitable earth.
I think we're going to have to talk about the big daddy of killers to be accurate. So what's in your book, Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute, LLC?
That book is mostly about ozone and what it's doing to trees. The agronomists around the world know. And in fact, New York Times just had an article come out in September that Justin Gillis wrote about ozone and the fact that they know that it's already causing annual crop to be diminished in the quantity that is produced, but also in the quality, so that they don't have the same nutritive value. So the article was just infuriating to me, because he talks about it, and the people, the researchers he talks to about it, look at it purely, and how can we genetically engineer crops to be less vulnerable to the impact of ozone? So this is wrong on so many levels. First of all, one of the worst things about ozone isn't the direct damage it does, although that's quite bad. It's the secondary issues with the insects and the fungus and the disease that start attacking plants that have been weakened by ozone. That impact is phenomenal. It's like climate. Like, it's like CO2 is the initial forcing with climate, but what really gets you is the amplifying feedback, like ice melt and the change in albedo. Those are far more important, and that's what pushes you over those tipping points than the initial CO2. And the same thing is with ozone. Ozone is very, very bad for plants. But when you add in the insects and the disease and the fungus that come after, that's what really wipes stuff out. So when they're talking about annual crops and trying to find crops that are more resistant, that doesn't do anything for the wild plants that are out there that, in a larger sense, we're more dependent on, you know, for oxygen and just making rainfall and keeping the world from turning into a desert and things like that. So if you engineer annual crops, it does nothing well for perennial crops because the damage is cumulative. So all those things like, you know, rhubarb and asparagus and stuff, that they get damaged year after year after year. And that's true even more for trees. So especially trees out in the wild, I mean, you can engineer as many crops as you want, but what kind of a monoculture are we going to live in, even presuming they do it, which they've been trying for years and they really have not had much success. Anyway, the book is really mainly about those issues.
We're going to have to wrap it up there, Gail. I'll ask you about the Apocalypse Library another time. I'll toss a link in that to my blog at ecoshock.info. We've been talking with Gail Zawacki. I find her blog called Wit's End is kind of addictive. Gail is passionate. She's witty herself. She ties together threads that make sense, as you can hear. You can find the blog at witsendnj.blogspot.com. So that's witsendnj.blogspot.com, or find a link in my show blog. And you can also download that book, Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute, at the website. Gail, thank you so much for visiting with us.
Thank you so much, Alex. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's a shame to end. I know we could talk for an hour, but I've really got a lot from our conversation so far, and I hope to have you back again.
Okay. Talk to you soon. Take care.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Be sure and check out this week's Radio EcoShock blog when it comes out on Wednesday. Gail sailed through a lot of cutting-edge material. All of it is backed up by recent papers and articles you will want. Follow all the links at ecoshock.info. Frank Rotering talked about Naomi Klein's new book, This Changes Everything. Naomi will be my guest on Radio EcoShock in 2 weeks' time. Gail Zawacki mentioned Stanford's Mark Jacobson, who worked out a path to a world powered by renewables by 2030. Mark will join us soon on the show. But next week, I want to dive into a great gaping sinkhole of mainstream media news coverage. No doubt you've seen fast clips about the two typhoons flooding Japan lately. They don't tell you what is happening at the Fukushima nuclear disaster site, where tons of radioactive water flows straight into the Pacific Ocean on a good day. It's time for a Fukushima update with our best guide, nuclear engineer Arne Gunderson. Plus, Arne has been sending reports to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission about California's most dangerous nuclear reactor, Diablo Canyon. As we found out from Fukushima, a blown reactor anywhere in the world quickly becomes everybody's problem, no matter where you live. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our SoundCloud page went over 10,000 listens this week. Check that out. Get all our past programs as free MP3 downloads from the show website at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you for listening, and thanks for supporting this show on your nonprofit radio station. Keep them going. I'll close out with a bit of my latest music.